Hey guys, you're listening to the most captivating podcast in iTunes. That's right, the Elite Man Podcast, where we turn average men into elite men every day. We interview the very best experts from the lifestyle, health, fitness, social, and even entrepreneurial worlds. And with their help, we give you some of the best advice on the planet. Subscribe now if you haven't already and enjoy the show. And oh yeah, if you really enjoy it, leave us a review.
On today's episode, episode number 175, entitled How to Transform Your Greatest Struggles into Your Most Important Life Lessons, I chat with Tom Satterley. Tom Satterley is a former Delta Force Command Sergeant Major of 20 years whose life was portrayed in the movie Black Hawk Down. In today's episode, Tom talks about his life in one of the most elite military units in the world, the highly acclaimed Delta Force, and the many experiences he had whilst being a member, including that of the notorious Battle of Mogadishu, Somalia, the battle depicted in the Black Hawk Down movie. Tom dives into the intensity of the battle, the horror he saw, and the scars it left him, both emotionally and mentally, for many years, even leading to a suicide attempt at one point. But like the true warrior he is, Tom also talks about pulling himself out of it all, regaining his life, and becoming an even better man after these struggles. And he shares with us how we can all grow from similar hardships and also become better by conquering them. If you're wondering how to overcome your greatest struggles and transform these obstacles into your greatest life lessons, check this episode out now. You are going to love it. Hey, just a quick reminder to sign yourself up for the Elite Man newsletter if you haven't yet. Get behind-the-scenes access to bonus tips, strategies, and techniques to becoming the best man you can be, exclusively on the Elite Man newsletter. Go to elitemanmagazine.com/newsletter and sign yourself up right now. Again, that's elitemanmagazine.com/newsletter. And now, a quick word from our fantastic sponsors. Ashwagandha is an adaptogenic herb that's been used in Ayurvedic medicine for thousands of years. As an adaptogen, it's great at combating stress and preventing the release of excess cortisol. By regulating the body's physiological response to stress, ashwagandha is believed by a number of researchers to be able to stave off the anxiolytic effects of day-to-day and even acute stress. In one very impressive double-blind placebo-controlled study conducted in 2000, 88.2% of all participants who took a form of the ashwagandha herb saw a marked improvement in their anxiety levels after weeks 2 and 6, the predetermined follow-up times for observance. The link to this research article, by the way, is in the show notes. Certainly more research should be conducted, but the more this wonder herb is being studied, the more promise it shows. As a suspected potent antioxidant and anti-inflammatory, its effects on the brain and body have been touted to help support everything from thyroid function to adrenal fatigue to energy levels, brain cell activity, and even immune system virility, to name a few. And if you're excited like I am about this herb, I've got fantastic news. It's our latest Elite Life Nutrition product. That's right. After getting together with our world-class manufacturing team, we've put together an ashwagandha formula that's literally the best on the market. Created in our GMP-certified facilities right here in America, our Elite Life Nutrition ashwagandha promises to give you the highest quality of ashwagandha money can buy. Go to elitelifenutrition.com/ashwagandha right now to order your wonder herb today. That's ashwagandha. I know, it's not the easiest to spell, but it's certainly one of the healthiest herbs you can get your hands on. Again, that's elitelifenutrition.com/ashwagandha. All right, guys, we're live. It's Justin Stenstrom from elitemanmagazine.com, and my guest today is Tom Satterley from allsecurefoundation.org. Tom, thanks so much for coming on the show, man.
Thank you, Justin. It's my pleasure for sure to be here.
Yeah, man. As I mentioned in the intros a couple moments ago, you are or part of the inspiration for the movie Black Hawk Down and had a pretty interesting career in the military. But you're a very interesting guy. You were the basis or part of the basis for the movie Black Hawk Down and had some issues over the last few years, but have sort of corrected those and learned from your past experiences to help other people, which is what you do now. But for those who may not know your story, can you take just a minute or two and talk about what it is you do now and how you got to that point helping others?
Okay, I have multiple jobs now, but what you're talking about, what we do now is we have a nonprofit and a for-profit organization. We have allsecurefoundation.org, and then we have All Secure Mission. All Secure Mission is the for-profit, to where we'll release very low-cost classes that people who don't want to go out and get help can download, buy for 25 to 150, whatever it is that they want dollars. Follow the program for health, nutrition, reintegration to the family, marriage counseling, things that guys don't typically want to go out for, or those who have packed up and moved, say, to Montana to get away from it all. You know, I found that a lot of people pack up, get away from society that they hate now for some reason, or that they just want to be removed from, and all they do is they're taking their problems with them alone. And now they have no one to help out, and they're remote from doctors. So trying to get them a way to get help without having to travel 200 miles to find one. And if it gets them off the couch just to get them to a doctor, then that's great. But it's very low cost. It also helps fund our nonprofit, AllSecureFoundation.org, AllSecure Foundation, which is a nonprofit. We are a resource library for those who need help. My wife, Jen, when we first met, was looking for multiple ways to help me with my PTS. And she was having so much difficulty finding it in St. Louis, not understanding that it's not a big military community here, which would have made it more difficult anyway. All she knew that it was extremely difficult to find help. And then when she would find help, they would not take TRICARE, which is the military's version of insurance. So we ended up paying cash here and there to give me help, and she would work on getting discounts. So she started looking at different ways to help more and more people, because she gave up her job in film and photography after 20 some years of that to start helping veterans as well. So she realized how hard it was. So that organization is designed to help those who aren't quite doing so well, and then you have to search the web or search something to find help, and you're not all there anyway. So we're here to make it easier for you, and then we're here to get you funding. We're here to get you there. And typically, in the time that somebody will call me or my wife, within a minute, we're texting other people while we're on the phone, you know, the status, the situation, what's going on, how far along are we, are they drunk, are they on drugs, are they this or that, and who can get to them the fastest and next. And by the time I'm off the phone with them or my wife's off the phone with them, they've already been set up with a place. They're already talking to administration. And there's really almost no backing out now. They've made that commitment of what they really need in life. And we have yet to have a person call back and regret it. They send comments when they can. You know, they're basically kind of prison. They take your phones away from you and everything else. So when they can, what we find enlightening for us is, you know, as a parent, your kids go off to basic or college, you get that text, hey, mom, doing all right? And you're like, oh, my baby, you know? We get that all the time with veterans. They go and they're like, I love life. Thank you. You saved me. So that's reason enough for me to do it right there, you know? So that's what we're doing. We're trying to make it easier for people to get the help that they need and then help them get the funding as well.
Yeah. How prevalent is this issue with PTSD with veterans, have you found?
It's daily. It is we're teaming up with as many as we can, and there's some that we found that aren't going down the same path as us, so we stick away. There's others that have actually stated, well, we're kind of competition. And so we team up with the ones that state, I wish that they would take my business model and build 50 more places like this. Who cares? You can't help enough veterans. There's that many. You talk 22 a day. 22 a day that commit suicide. That's so much more than we've lost during the war. Both sides combined, you know, both Iraq and Afghanistan, and probably enemy and friendly side combined, we've lost that many people just to suicide alone. So it's a pretty big problem, and now we're looking at their children. I think my wife could help me with the statistics on that. The number of veteran children who are now starting to commit suicide is on the rise by like 7% higher than civilian suicide. So PTS is not just a veteran issue. It's a family issue. It really affects the entire family.
Yeah, it's really sad, of course. And like you said, it seems like it's getting worse anyway. So it's great to have, you know, foundations like yours. I had another guy on the show too a while back. I don't know if you've heard of him, Andrew Marr. He was a Green Beret. He runs something similar to it. I think it's called, I can't remember the exact name, but it's called like Warrior Angel Foundation or something like that. Really cool. But he's essentially doing a very similar work where he helps out a lot of veterans, because him also, like you, had PTSD after, and he got his from a, I think it was a blast, someplace, Iraq or one of the Middle East countries. There was some kind of bomb that went off and it was a blast, and he had traumatic brain injury from just the blast, the impact. Yeah. It didn't actually hit him, but the like sound right. waves or whatever, the vibrations or whatever it is that causes it can oftentimes lead to TBI. So he was working with a guy by the name of Dr. Mark Gordon, who I believe yeah. is out in California. And they ended up pinpointing his issues just to an imbalance in his neurotransmitter. So they got him on some supplements, some hormone balancing things, and he was fine in like a few months, whereas he was severely depressed and suicidal for like a year or two afterwards. And it was simply just a matter of his chemicals, his neurotransmitters upstairs being off balance. So I think, you know, the work that you're doing, guys like him, is really helpful and can save so many countless lives of just people who need a little help, whether it's something like that where it's, you know, an imbalance upstairs, or whether it's more support like you guys offer. I think the work you're doing is profound and much needed.
So his organization is an organization that we would tend to bond with, because basically biochemistry education, what you said with supplements and with health, so it's number one. I mean, what goes in your mouth goes to your gut, goes to your brain. It feeds what tells your body what to do. Your body would pretty much basically heal itself. And I'm very careful when I say this. I'll get the doctor to call me. I'll get somebody over here to call me and just try to prove me wrong. But you know what? I'll always be wrong at something. But your body will heal itself. When we retire, we run out of things to do. We're not told what to do daily, even if we're in a higher position. We don't know what to do, so what do? We go to the bar, we hang out, we drink. What's at the bar? Chips and the quick snacks, and the eating habits go to south. And then you get the little bitty beer gut, which you're like, uh-oh. Well, I didn't used to have that. I used to have a six-pack, you know, and if you're a Navy SEAL, you got, you know, like a 12-pack going, but Army, you get a six-pack. And now that goes away, so you get a little depressed. You get afraid to go to the gym. It starts piling on itself, and it really all started out with nutrition. And now you're starting to take pills from the VA to feel better, which is less, you know, that's further from nutrition than we want. That's the wrong direction. So my wife has definitely studied and put many, many, many hours and nights burning the candle all night long on nutrition and how to help veterans. And she actually designed a pack with a company, a multi-level, you know, marketing company that we joined for, to get me supplements when she was looking to help me. She became a certified health coach and started studying more and more, joined the MLM without telling me, which was fine. I had enough veterans to help and it worked for me. So we helped as many as we could, but it's expensive. They want to make money on these things. And so she designed a pack, and they called it the Warriors Pack. They discounted it so heavily, they don't give the bonuses on it, they don't give the points on it, but it's everything that a veteran would need in a one-month time to cleanse, balance, and build your body and get it started right again. And then after that, you're talking $100 a month in nutraceutical-grade supplements versus the other brands that I don't want to mention that full of fillers and things like that you just kind of spending your money on. But when you said that he's talking about nutrition and everything, it's like right on. That's spot on the money right there is to getting that right. Alcohol and exercise, people start drinking more alcohol and doing a little less exercise. And they're reliving those days of back when they could, you know, drink 12-pack at night or more. I don't know how much, who kept count. And then get up the next day and go for a 10-mile run, throw up, keep running, you know. And they're like, oh, that's a sign of manhood back in the day. You know, that and being quiet. So we exercise, we drink a lot, and we keep it quiet. But now we're finding that that's not working with retirees or those we've got now, because they lost the tribe mentality where they're no longer fit. So they've stopped talking. So they need talk therapy. They need to get it out. They've stopped exercising, so they need to exercise. And they've started drinking more. So all those things that they can no longer keep up with, and what used to be fun and part of a culture that we're trying to break, is counter to what they need anymore in life, but they keep doing it to try to fit into the same culture, you know? So it's, the harder they fight to stay in that culture they used to live in, the more they hurt themselves. The more they realize they need to look out the windshield instead of in the rearview mirror what they used to do, the better off they are quicker. And I would, you know, dollar to donut, whatever that saying is, everybody that has progressed and gotten better will tell you the same thing. I've stopped living in the past. I've started taking accountability for my own mistakes and actions instead of pointing other fingers and blaming everyone else for why I feel like horrible. You know, I blame the VA. I blame the government. I blamed, you know, I joined up for all those things. I volunteered. So who am I to, who would I be to blame anybody else but me? I picked that job. You know, I don't even like people. I don't think people feel bad for you when they say thank you for your service. But when they go on like, oh, but I'm just a doctor, or I'm just a cook, or I'm just a whatever, I go, we need every job on the planet. And every job on the planet is also in the military as well. You know, and when I got out and I'm looking for what can I do for my future, there's not a lot of room for killing anymore. You know, when my son wanted to join the Army, I want to be a sniper, I want to be a ranger, I want to be this and that. And I go, those are hobbies, man. Look for a skill. Get yourself a job. Think of the future, which I did not do. I just did my thing at the time, like kids do. They don't listen to, you know, my parents. So hopefully someone else told my son some good advice at some point.
What made you want to enter the military in the first place way back when?
This is a quick one. on my way to a John Cougar concert from Columbus, Indiana to Indianapolis, Indiana, give or take about an hour car drive. My friend had come back from basic training while I was building houses for a living. The guy that owned the company wanted me to take over the company years down the road. I'm fresh out of high school, playing with some college, blowing some parents' money, you know, things like that. And in that hour, I went from never thought of the Army other than making fun of my brother for joining between junior and senior year in high school, making fun of him, to I joined the Army. And I went in for 4 years, college money, in and out, $25,000, $3,500 cash bonus upon completion of AIT, which back in 1986 seemed like $1 million to me, you know. And 3 years into it, I started having a change of heart, change of mind about what the Army was to me and what life meant to me and what my commitments could be. And that's when things started changing for me. But that was literally a one-hour car drive of let's go listen to John Cougar, who even knows who that is anymore, boom. I came home and told my parents the next morning, hey, guess what? I joined the Army. You know, they're like, what? You did what? I'm like, too late. Sorry. I was old enough to be able to do that. I was just 18 at the time, so.
Yeah. No, I know who John Cougar Mellencamp is. He's a he's a legend and one of my favorites when I threw on classic rock.
Yeah,
but
story, and I get those looks like, oh, oh my goodness, I need to start finding some people my age to talk to.
But all right, so you say about 3 years into it, was your entire tenure in the military, was it 4 years or did it last longer? Because you said about 3 years into it, you started having a change of heart.
Yeah, well, I had signed up for four. To get the $25,000 of college money. And so I got to Germany in probably June of 86. And platoon sergeants at the time back then were typically Vietnam veterans. And they were a little bit burnt out. I get it now. Now I know why. But back in the day, I just thought these guys are tired. They're, you know, do this, do that. And who cares? Motor pool Mondays. I was a combat engineer, mechanized, which means we have these M113 APCs, you know, track vehicles with engineer tools hanging off of them to help the tankers. That's what you did. And every Monday you're in the motor pool changing oil, fixing this, fixing that. And I was not excited about it. Our platoon sergeant was a former Hungarian army sergeant. So he had crossed over at some point in his life, and he was different. He was motivated. He knew more about Europe. He knew the schools available in Europe. So he took us as the very first full platoon to go to French Commando School as a complete platoon. And we went down there, and I got a little taste of special operations, French style, you know, every nasty thing they could do to you, you know, throwing you from tree to tree and urinating in the water as you're crawling through it and laughing at you and giving you crappy food and spitting on you and all that stuff. I hate to say it was interesting. And then he took us to the Swiss March. It's a 40 miles a day hike in the Swiss Alps for 5 days. Most people do it for fun and drink beer along the way. We did it with our rucksacks on and, you know, and that was it. We did that for three days. That was a good experience. And it played out later when I realized 40 miles seems a lot, and it is a lot when you're tired, but you can do it. You know, you can walk 40 miles with 50, 60 pounds on your back. And then we went to platoon confidence training in Bad Tölz, Germany, which was some SF guys, some special forces guys, and some Rangers running a platoon confidence training exercise, rappelling, patrolling, all the high-speed stuff that we never got to do. And then they had one slot open up for German Ranger School. And there was going to be an officer from the battalion, the headquarters battalion. They get the information first. One of the officers was like, I'm going to that school. And I raised my hand. I'm like, why does he get to go? Out of 600 people, why don't we have a competition and we'll send the best American? You know, I didn't think it'd be me. You know, okay, I just ruined that story, right? I just ruined the end of that story. But whoever thought it would have been me, but I thought it should be somebody other than him. So we had a Green Beret who had just arrived into Germany at the time. That's the first Green Beret I've ever really seen. And I was like, whoa, this guy's cool. You know, he's different. He's got a Green Beret. That means something. And they put him in charge. And he designed a three-day competition of land navigation, rucksack march, shooting, physical fitness, pull-ups, sit-ups, you know, mountain hikes and just weird swim tests, just weird stuff that I'd never done before. And I think maybe 300 or 400 people competed for on that 3-day competition, and I won it. So I got to go.
How did you win? You just performed the best?
Just performed the best. Best running times, not quitting, mm-hmm. not getting lost during land navigation, things like that. Attention to detail, like you must carry this at this certain time. You must have your rucksack packed this way. And I was just very meticulous. They sent an interpreter with me because they don't speak much English in that school at all. And he didn't make it past like the first week. So I spent the next six weeks trying to talk to Germans. And you know how you kind of break the tension or the stress of being in the woods and not eating for 4, 5, 6 days at a time with jokes? And then here I would be telling jokes to a group of guys that looked intently at me. And then all of a sudden it's just kind of like, punchline comes and you get some German guys talking and you're like, that didn't work. You know, I'm not speaking German. So I'm like, I'm just going to go pull security, polish my boots and cry. I'll be out here by the wood line. You know, I'm just going to go sit here for 5 more weeks and cry. So after all of that, I realized that there was more than what I was doing. And so I tried to re-enlist for the Green Berets and there was like a 20, I don't know, it was a bonus attached to it. I don't know how much it was at the time. It was a lot of money. But I could not re-enlist because I had been promoted to E5, sergeant so fast, based on those schools that I had gone to. My troop sergeant sent, or my, yeah, my platoon sergeant sent me to soldier of the month, soldier of the quarter, and soldier of the year. So I won that. And then I had also taken my squad to Sapper Stakes, which is an engineering competition in Germany, and all these teams from the U.S. and German teams come, and we went and we did pretty well in Sapper Stakes. With you're doing your job, your military job, you're probing for mines. I mean, it was the fun job of the day back then, probing for Russian landmines and your Bangalore torpedoes and blowing fences and towing tanks out of ditches and things like that. And so we fared pretty well. And when I won Soldier of the Year, they sent me to the E5 board pretty early. And there was one question asked of me, it was from our first sergeant. And he was definitely an old Vietnam vet. He used to jump out of his 1.5-story window from his office and land on the ground and just look at him. He was an older gentleman, too. And he'd look around and he'd be like, who runs this motherfucker? We'd all jump up, Raiders run this motherfucker, because we were the Alpha Company Raiders. So my E5 board He looks left and right at all the other sergeant majors and first sergeants, and he's like, "We only have one question for Sergeant Satterley, don't we?" And I was a specialist at the time. And they were like, "Roger that. What is it?" And he jumps up. He goes, "Who runs this motherfucker?" And I just jumped up and I screamed, "Raiders run this motherfucker." He goes, "All right, you're out of here." And I left, and that was E5. So I didn't get to go to a school that you're supposed to go to get E5, which means I cannot reenlist for the Bear program for the Green Berets because I'm missing that school. They won't send me to that school because I already have E5. And they want to send E4s to help them make E5. So I have to reenlist for jump school. I'm like, I'm getting to Fort Bragg. So I reenlisted for jump school just to get to Fort Bragg, made jump school, got to Fort Bragg, and then went to the Green Beret recruiting office and then signed up, you know, with no bonus, no nothing. Just let me go to selection. If I make selection, qualification course, great. I'll be an engineer. All right, I've been doing that already. That's got to be easy, right? And then after that, they sent me to language school for 4 months on Fort Bragg for Persian Farsi, which, I don't know. That's 4 months of futility right there. But I was approached by two guys that I went to the qualification course with, and I just thought they were regular guys trying to become, you know, 18 Charlies as well, special operations engineer sergeants. And those two guys were in the unit already. And they were just changing their military occupational specialty. They were changing their jobs. I've learned to kind of explain some of my acronyms because I've been told that, hey, I told Tom at the beginning of an interview not to use any acronyms. And in the first 3 seconds, it was all acronyms. So I'm trying to explain any acronym. And anything that if I say you don't understand or you think anybody might not, please let me know. I'll understand it. But so I thought they were just looking to change jobs, careers. And they were doing it to help get promoted. Because when you're in Delta, you get promoted based on the unit that you came from. So you're competing against those guys. But you may not be doing that job. If I'm a mechanic, I go Delta to be an operator. I become an operator. I'm not doing any mechanic stuff. So when it comes time for promotion, they're going to look at it and go, he doesn't do any mechanic stuff. So let's promote these guys over here who do mechanic stuff. Sounds a little silly, but a job's a job, you know, and the guy gets promoted based on what he does and how well he does in his job. So they were changing their job careers to something like Special Forces because now it kind of correlates to what you're doing. And so I didn't know that. And then they said, hey, we think you have what it takes to be in Delta. And I was like, okay, what's that? You know, they're like, oh, they explained to me a little bit about what it was. And I'm like, that sounds cool. I'll do that. Where do I sign up for that? So I went ahead and signed the paperwork, did the PT test for that while I was in language school. Got sent to 5th Group at Fort Campbell, Kentucky, and was there for about 3 months. And then during that 3 months, I had gone to selection back at Fort Bragg, or back to West Virginia, gone to selection, made it back to Fort Campbell, Kentucky, and then packed back up and moved right back to Fort Bragg for the next 20 years. And that's kind of how I got to Delta. It was just 4 years in and out, and then within 5 years, I was in Delta, ready to start a 25-year total in the Army career.
Wow. So you're kind of, it sounds like you didn't plan on doing this at all when you first signed up for those first 4 years, and then you just kind of, you know, went into it and said, fuck it, I'm going to dive into this next venture and, you know, went from there. Is Delta, is that part of the Army Rangers, or is that something separate?
It's something completely and utterly different. Delta is like they got tier one, tier two, you know, and just down or whatever. Delta is tier one. We answer to basically the president, National Command Authority, the Joint Chiefs. So you have less people to go through to get things done. You get the higher risk missions. You get the no fail. Hey, we need such and such done. It needs to be done absolutely, positively. Has to be destroyed overnight. Call Delta, you know, and then you get SEAL Team 6. Yeah, I'm going to play around with that. No, wait a minute. So there's no video. So you got Delta and, you know, and SEAL Team 6. It's about even with us down in here, you know. So, and that's a good brotherhood friendly joke. But, and then you have Whiteside SEALs as well, which you have Rangers, you have Whiteside SEALs, you have Green Berets. We could argue all day and people will argue all day on who's better and why. There's more Rangers. They're younger. They can be more violent. You know, it's like, okay, we need to take a beach. There's not a lot of, thought in that other than we need a lot of people to take a beach. Who do you think of when you think of taking a beach? You know? Yeah. Well, yes, the SEALs, they're going to come in and do point stuff, but there's not that many of them, so you got Marines.
Oh, yeah.
Tons of Marines. So if we need something done like that, you know, and then you got point targets. We've got the SEALs that'll come in and do this and that, or boats, specialty missions. So I'd say the highest priority, and I'm skewed because I was in the unit, it was Delta. Ask most people, you'll get that comparison between SEAL Team 6 and Delta forever. Of course I'm going to say us. I'm bound to say that. I could give lots of reasons why, whether it be the selection process or the age or the maturity level or the psyche vows or whatever, but they have a job to do. We have a job to do, you know, and jobs are just different at times. But so if you've got like the regular Army and then you've got Rangers and SF, and then, you know, you got different specialty units that work your way up. So it's definitely not attached. They're under the same combat command of JSOG, Joint Special Operations Command. So they are considered special operations as well. And that's good that they finally have combined all that. MARSOC being the newest, you know, the Marine Special Operations Command. They used to just be recon because the Marines didn't want to call anybody special. In the Marines, it's everybody's the same. We're Marines. You're a Marine. We're all the same. Like, I beg to differ. People are different. You know, people are better at things than other people. You just have to admit it. And they finally got it. And they got it right because when you're special or special operations, you get more money. You know, there's more money allocated for that, which is good for the unit to get more training. So it's good that they finally, they're our newest, one of our newest members, you know.
How hard was the Delta training and how long did it last? Like, what's the dropout rate, by the way, if you know off the top of your head for people that try to complete the training?
I want to say I've heard 98%.
Wow. Over 98%. Holy shit.
They've had classes where one person passed out of 100 and some.
Wow. I think Navy SEALs is like 90% too, right? So it's even tougher than that, you think?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Wow. SEALs have like hell week. I like to call it, we have a hell month. You just never know what's going to happen. They got hell week. It's water. I don't want that job. You wouldn't catch me dead doing flutter kicks on the beach with my mask full of water, salt water, while they throw sand on me. It's not my thing, you know?
Just the water aspect of it's not your thing, you mean?
Yeah, the water. I mean, I'm not afraid of the water. It just wasn't my thing. It's a tough mental game to fight the thought of drowning, which is what you have to fight when you go to scuba school. They throw you through that ditch and dawn where, okay, go to the bottom of the pool, take all of your equipment off and stack it nice and neat, and then put it all back on, all while you're holding your breath. You know, people are like, whoa, me, I'm trying to put my stuff on. I run out of air and shoot to the top. I'm like, maybe I don't want to go to scuba school. You know, that's the one school I didn't go to. I went to Civilian Patty because I wanted to go look at some pretty fish, but I didn't want to go be forced underwater to hold my breath for anything. That's just not what I do. I don't like to be on, you know, I've played with those boats. I've ridden with those guys, the SBT guys that drive for the SEALs. Mm-mm. Nope. Don't. That's not what I want to do. I like to be on land. And those guys like to do the water thing. And that's why they joined the Navy. And that's how they ended up in the SEALs, you know. So, but our selection's about 30 days long. And the only stress really put on you, other than physical stress, because they'll put some physical stress on you, the mental stress is all self-induced. You're not yelled at. You're barely talked to by anybody. You know, they write on the chalkboard where to be, when to be, what to wear. Day one starts off very military talk because that's what we're all used to. Formation 06, out back on the north side, you know, front row on the toes on the first line, blah, 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 down into to the last second. And you set your clocks to the mess hall, you know, you set your watches to the mess hall clock. So, and it's very perfectly ran. I can say that. I've run it as an instructor, let's say four to six times. I just don't remember if it's four, five, or six. But and we are always on time. You have to memorize every class that they give you, whether your class is 4 hours long on how to read a map or how to pack a rucksack. Everything is memorized. Everything's practiced at least five times over. The driving is rehearsed. The timing is rehearsed. How long does it take your truck to roll down at this speed to pull out in front of the barracks so you stop and all your keys shut off at the same time? Everybody gets out of the car door and shuts it at the same time and opens the back of the truck at exactly the time we said we would be there. You'll see students just watching. And as soon as their second hand flips, you can see us flip the tarps up. I mean, that's how perfect we want it to be, because it's a mental thing. And then it goes to, you know, towards the end of the time, you look at the chalkboard and it says, see you out back around four. Doesn't tell you what to wear. Doesn't tell you anything. Just around 4 o'clock, more civilian stuff. And they want to see who can break away from that regimented military lifestyle and still function. And everything that they do up there is for purpose. It has a purpose. And there's very few people that know those purposes. And those are the things we don't share. You know, there's plenty of physical activity. Your rucksack gets heavier every week. Every 3 days, your rucksack weight goes up. The distances increase. The amount of points that you go to increase, and you think your brain is, okay, today we went to one, tomorrow we went to two, next day's three, oh, tomorrow's four, oh, tomorrow ends up being seven. You know, you go to five, you're like, what? There's another one? Oh, okay, it must be six today. What? There's another one? Mentally, guys quit right then. They can't get past the unexpected change. I just kind of, you know, you could read the book Delta Force. I think there was so much stuff about selection in there. I wish I'd have read it. I didn't. I just showed up and had no idea, and it might have been helpful for me that I just blindly went about and did what they told me to do daily, and I made it. And I had a good time. I love land navigation. I was in great shape. I love not being yelled at every day by somebody on what to do and how to do it. Just get this done. Here are your rules, and that's it. You know, don't be late, don't be light, and don't be out of uniform. And then you go through the psychological stuff after that. And then they either take you or they don't. So a lot of heartbreak, but a lot of energetic love in the end too. So
what do you think about it is makes it harder than the training for Navy SEALs or some of the other branches? Why do you think the dropout rate is the highest in Delta?
Maybe because it's self-induced. I think some of my worst nightmares in my own life have been self-induced versus what's been taught me or given to me or shown me. I can't speak to Navy SEAL selection, never been to it. It sure looks like it sucks. I've heard some good stories. I've been to SFAS, which is the Special Forces, you know, assessment and selection course. It's more team events. You got a team of 10 to 12 guys. And you got to move two Jeeps with the three wheels each on them 8 miles through sand, loose sand road. And you got your team to move both. Well, if you lose one or two guys, you still have to move those Jeeps. And you're hoping, okay, if we're going to lose one, let's lose five because they'll take a Jeep away, you know. So if not, you still have to do it as a team. So if you've got guys not pulling their weight, you can't control that. You can't yell at them. You can't give them encouragement. So in a way, that selection's difficult in itself, in its own way. You know what I mean? If you're a guy that doesn't put self-induced stress, brings it on yourself, and you can just kind of go with the flow, and you don't worry about when the end is, it'll come. The end always comes. You just put the weight that you're supposed to have, and you don't get lost. And if you do get lost, which there's two types of people in the world: those who have been lost, and those who are gonna get lost. I got lost a couple times, and I'm just, okay, all right. You know, the end of the world's coming. I got to find my way back. Always happens. Found my way back, got it going, got it, you know. But I think it's more difficult because of the self-induced stress. It's just guys really put a lot of pressure on themselves, and they'll really talk themselves out of quitting more so than anyone else could talk you out of quitting. that first doubt you plant in your own head, which is what I've learned in life, is to don't plant that seed of doubt. As soon as I do, you know, if you watch Naked and Afraid.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm addicted to Naked and Afraid. And I will watch those shows, and I can tell you when someone's going to quit. As soon as they start talking about their family. Oh, I miss my daughter. Or they're starting to snivel about how cold it is. No kidding, it's cold. Why are you talking about it? You're only reevaluating, you know, you're only reinforcing what you already know. You're giving yourself an out to quit verbally to your brain. When, even if you just thought it and didn't say it, you know, your words become your actions, your thoughts become words, words become actions. So I thought about quitting a lot. You know, I would think, if I get to the next trail and there's a truck there, I'm getting in the back of it. I'm done. And there wouldn't be a truck there. And I'd be like, ooh, thank goodness. I'd keep going. Next job, that's it. I get to the next trail and there's a truck there. There'd be a truck there. And I'm like walking. There's just a cadre sitting in the front. I'm like, maybe nope. Just keep walking. Had those words come out of my mouth, you know, then those would have become my actions. So you can always tell when someone's looking for a reason to quit, when mentally you could have fought through it.
If you wear contact lenses and find yourself dreading that annual appointment to renew your prescription, then you're going to love Simple Contacts. It's a fantastic new company that makes this annoying process very, well, simple. Simple Contacts lets you renew your expired contact lens prescription and reorder your brand of lenses from your phone or computer in just minutes. Simple Contacts brings the doctor's office to wherever you are, whenever you need it. You can take the Simple Contacts vision test online in 5 minutes, and a real doctor reviews it for you and renews your prescription. You save time, you save money, and you save yourself a major headache. And if you have an unexpired prescription, just upload a photo of it or your doctor's info and order lenses in just minutes for a great price. They do all the hard work for you. This is vision care for the 21st century. Also, Simple Contacts offers every brand of lenses imaginable, and their prices are unbeatable. The vision test is just $20. You can compare that with an annual appointment, which can cost over $200 without insurance. They have some of the best prices on contacts, and the shipping is free. Best of all, my listeners get $30 off their first Simple Contacts order. To save $30 on your lenses, just go to simplecontacts.com/elite or enter the promo code elite at checkout. I do want to mention that this isn't a replacement for your periodic full eye health exam. You still need those occasionally, but this is the most convenient way to renew your prescription and reorder your contacts if your vision hasn't changed. Again, check out simplecontacts.com/elite to get $30 off your first order now, or simply enter the promo code elite at checkout. Give it a try and thank me later.
What was your greatest challenge during your military experience? Was there some sort of conflict or battle or internal fight that went on at some point that you had to overcome? Like, how did you... What was the biggest challenge, and then how did you overcome that?
My biggest challenge, and I'd say when the switch of my life flipped, was in Somalia in 1993. I'd been in the unit probably just about 2 years at the time, and hadn't done much. I'd never been to war before, never been into a conflict before. I missed them all because of selections, or I was PCSing somewhere. Permanent change of station. I was moving to, you know, another location. So I missed those things, the Panamas and the Grenadas and whatnot. And, you know, as a soldier, I'm begging to go. I want to go to war. I want to get some. I'm, you know, because you don't think it goes both ways. You know, you think, oh, well, I want to go and win. You don't really think I want to go and watch my friends die around me, you know. So Somalia, 1993, we rehearsed for several months for that before we went over. And 3 and 4 October was the date that where my life changed. We'd done 4 or 5 missions prior to that. Nothing too bad. It was, you know, shots fired here and there. We'd come back, high five, tell good stories about, you see this, you see that. Yeah, I did what I was supposed to do. 3 October was different, immediately different. A lot of stars and moons lined up for the bad guys that day, and that happens. I mean, you know, we're well trained, we're the best in the world, but we're not invincible, and we thought we were. And you know, when you see your first helicopter get shot down while you're in combat, you kind of you try to cover up the jokes. We were still kind of joking about, we hope we make it back for dinner. Because I just finished a 5-mile run before we got called out, and I was already dehydrated and hungry. Threw my kit on, and we took off. Didn't take night vision. Didn't take water or food. I just took my rifle and just the ammo I had. Be back in an hour. Let's go. You know, cocky. You know, we all got there. And when I started hearing about people getting injured or possibly being dead, and then, you know, and then saw the helicopter get shot down, just about at exfil, things started to change a little bit. It's like, okay, our mission has completely changed. We started moving up the street. We had to head east first for about 2 or 3 blocks, and we had to turn north for 2 or 3 blocks as we're getting, you know, kind of helped along into where this helicopter has crashed. And we have to go fast because the Somalians are also on their way there. Thousands and thousands of Somalians are on their way there. And we went in with, you know, 100. So we're giving up security, and we're using speed, and we're running. And we can't slow down and hide and think and make a plan. So every street we cross, just bullets flying everywhere, and you're just going. And people were getting injured. It wasn't much in my brain at the time. It was my job. I was focused. And then we turned north, and I remember looking across the street and saw Earl Fillmore. We were wearing plastic helmets at the time. You know, the old Pro-Tec skateboard helmets. They look cool and stop you from smacking your head. That's about it. And Earl was shooting up the street. I turned. I'm shooting up the street. Friend of mine comes out in the middle of the road with me, shoots a 203 40-millimeter grenade up the street where this guy was coming from. And by the time, 15, 20 seconds, you know, to run out to the street, shoot, look back. Two guys are dragging Earl's body into a building. He'd got shot right in the head. That was it. And that's when you realize you're not invincible. You can't call time out and go home. You know, those movies that you watch where your friends get killed or somebody gets killed, and the next thing you know, you're back in the rear, and the threat's gone, and you're dealing with it. It's like, nope, they're coming, and they want all of you. You know, you might be next. Never saw Earl again. I mean, I never saw Earl's body again. And literally never saw Earl again after that. So there's a team held up there. We got to push forward a couple blocks more to the site. So we pushed more. The east side of the street was getting hammered. I don't know if it was the shadows, the sun setting. I don't know why our side didn't get hammered as bad. Finally got to the crash site, kicked in the door of the house. There was probably 6, I don't know, teenage to younger middle school girls there, two older women, and then one older male who we handcuffed, put in the living room corner as far back from the street as we could. The whole family was sat back there, and that's your rest position. You know, you get to sit there to rest watching the family. Everybody else had a job out a window guarding because we were surrounded, thousands, and they came all night long. And so that went from a 1-hour mission to one of the longest sustained firefights since Vietnam at the time, 18 straight hours, to where we lost 18 of our own. Wow. And with I think over 98 wounded out of the low hundreds that we had, and I think some of the numbers are 3,000 to 5,000 killed of the enemy, and unknown, determined, wounded, and who died after that. But that was just what we found out, was we were blocks away from an Al-Qaeda training camp back in the day when we really didn't know who Al-Qaeda was. And so they came with their RPGs that day, and they were ready to go. That, along with, it was near the Bakara market, which is where they sold all of the weapons and things like that. So they had readily available gear, if you will. They had set up certain plans to where they were blocking the streets with burning tires. So our convoy was being diverted and lost and being turned around. So there was just a litany of things that just all lined up that day to make it a horrible day. And so when my switch flipped was when we had run out of ammo, no water, no food. We'd run out of ammo, and it still wasn't even midnight. I don't know what time it was, but it was one of those things where I'm going to die tonight. So I'm going to die tonight the best possible way I can. I'll do as much as I can, and I'll save as many people as I can, but I'm not going to make it home. So why worry about home anymore? And I think that's when that all kind of hit me. I didn't know it at the time. I mean, I knew I made that decision. It was a conscious decision that, you know what, fuck it. What have I got to lose? You know, I'll run on that street. I'll go grab those two Rangers who just got hit. I don't really care. You know, I'll carry water across the street and back. And I tell the story each time because it's funny because, you know, you're running in slow motion carrying 2 5-gallon water jugs where bullets are zinging. You're like, well, when's it going to happen, you know? And you make it and you're like, all right, wow, okay, now I got to go back. You know, it's not fun to do. And I'm not saying I wasn't scared at all. I was terrified. But I had resigned myself to the fact that it was going to happen. So it was more acceptable, I guess. And then I think that's when my brain decided that the rest of my life, everything might be a threat. You know, I wouldn't know that for years later. I just thought that that was my job. That's how I looked at life. Everything was a threat. Everything needed to be assessed and watched and monitored, and every restaurant exit needed to be marked out. And every time, and I still do this to this day, when I sit in a restaurant, I'll make eye contact with everybody and see who looks weird, who looks like they might be in a hurry, or who's got a funny looking bag, you know, or who's sweating, or who's just sitting there having a good time. I give it a quick once over, where's the exits, and I'm done. You know, I used to sit back in a corner and place my wife with her back to the door so I could talk to her and always watch what's going on. And she plays that game of she'll sit in a corner and make me put my back to the door to try to get me to get over some of that stuff, you know. Living in the red, living in the yellow, or living in the green, you know. I try to live in the green or yellow mostly. Unless, you know, we're downtown St. Louis, and then it goes to the red a little bit. But that's probably the time in my life where it changed, because after that, a lot of my combat decisions, I wasn't a leader then in Somalia, but I had gone back to combat as a leader after that in Iraq a lot. And there'd be things that would come out of my mouth. Like people would run up to me and say, hey, so-and-so just got blown up or shot or something. And my answer would be, I don't give a fuck. I've got 40 other guys I got to worry about, you know? If that did mess me up, it'd have been a bad time to tell me, because I have decisions to make. So you can't ever give in to your emotions until you fully have that opportunity to do so without putting other people's lives at risk. So that's how I've learned to manage my emotions, which is completely and utterly the wrong way to manage your emotions. It's not managing them at all. It's shutting them down completely. You know, it's where I did it with my family. I did it to the whole, I don't care. Everything's a threat. And what's the best way to deal with a threat? Take it out or forget it altogether, you know? And I think that's a lot of where my life started to go.
I want to come back to this part of your life and how you managed to get over this problem, because it seems like it started right then, that day, where you started getting some of these problems later on, and especially the mental aspect of it, how you were able to overcome that part of things. But just a couple of quick follow-ups to the story. We're talking about the couple of days that the Black Hawk Down movie was based off of, right? That conflict in Somalia, that's when it happened?
Yes.
Okay. And then you have all these guys basically being killed around you, your own people are getting wounded. You had 98 wounded. I think it was 18 killed. Is that right?
Yes.
All these people getting killed or wounded. How do you end up getting out of that? Because you basically, it sounded like you almost just accepted the fact that you were going to get killed. How did you end up getting out of that situation to you know, be here today and actually share the story and you know, later on, of course, help so many other people with their problems? How are you here today talking to us?
Running the Mogadishu Mile. Funny story. When I was in high school, I started off as a long-distance runner, 2 mile, mile runner, and cross country. And then one of my coaches decided, you're a pretty powerful runner, even though you're a short guy. So I went into the 110 high hurdles and the 300 meter low hurdles or whatever they were back in the day. which was a nightmare for me. I ended up being like the only white guy at regionals every year. You know, guys knocking over hurdles and still beating me, and I'm trying to run over every hurdle, and I can't do it. I just can't do it. I don't have it. But I had the strong running ability. So doing a book right now, and I know the co-author wants to connect a little bit of that with the Mogadishu Mile, but honestly, that's what saved our lives. The two of the armored vehicles made it there that early that morning when the sun was coming up. We used the chains and pulled the helicopter parts off of the pilots. They were trapped underneath the frame, which is why we spent the night there. We weren't leaving without their bodies. Make a quick plan, you know, with these Malaysians or Pakistanis. Okay, listen, we're going to go along these vehicles with you, and we'll follow you back to where the tanks are and all the other vehicles, and we'll get inside. You know, but first I try to get inside one of the vehicles. You know, we're throwing the bodies on top. Time to climb inside and go, and open the door, and literally the door is pulled shut. There's no room. I mean, we have a joke in the military: how many people can you fit in a helicopter or a vehicle? It's one more. There's always room for one more. No, not this day. Door shut right back on me, and it was just a group of us that had to run the Mogadishu Mile. And so, okay, we'll run along these armored vehicles as help us, you know, protect us from a lot of these bullets flying, since we're almost, well, I was pretty much out of ammo already too, even though we had a resupply quick resupply that night. All right, go. Vehicles, gone. We're like, well, there we go with that plan. You know, that plan doesn't work. So here we are running, exposed again, extremely dehydrated and sleep deprived, running the Mogadishu Mile. And I remember at one point I stopped to look at an Apache that was going to rocket the Blackhawk that we had left behind. We had already put thermite on him, but you got to destroy it so the enemy doesn't get it. And I'm watching as we turn, headed south, we're going to turn back west. And I remember stopping at the end, watching the helicopter, thinking, this ought to be cool, I'm going to watch. And it took, I don't know, 30 seconds, he still didn't launch anything. And I thought, what am I doing? We're not back on the range. I looked and there was nobody there. I mean, the streets were empty. I just took off running. I'm running as fast as I can. And at some point, one of the little alleyways, a guy that wasn't even on our team, he ended up becoming an operator later. He was a support medic, jumped out, grabbed me and pulled me, threw me inside where the other team was, right as an RPG hit the wall and detonated. Now, he didn't do it because he knew the RPG was coming. He just did it because he saw me running and was trying to show me where we were. He's the one who took the RPG shrapnel to his ear and lost a little bit of his hearing. To this day, I thank him for that. I don't know. I would have run right into that sucker. And then, you know, he wouldn't have had anything done wrong with him. But, got back to the vehicles, jumped in the back of two Humvees with the 10th Mountain Group that had come out, was there, unarmored Humvees. And we're all supposed to go back to the Pakistani stadium, which I think was blocks away, as opposed to the airfield, which was miles away. So we load up in the back of our vehicles. There's other guys. There's tanks. They're shooting at everything. And I'm like, all right, we're good now, right? We got tanks. And these Humvees take off. I'm thinking, well, they know where we're going. I don't know where we're going. You know, I found out later where we were supposed to go. They drove us the multi-mile route back to the back gate of the airfield. And there's no one else in sight. And it's just two vehicles. And I'm sitting there, I'm like, where's everyone else? Where is everyone else? Do we need to go back out? We need to go, let's go get some ammo and go back out. So we drove all the way around the back of the airfield. And that's when I saw six to 10 U.S. bodies laying on the street, covered in poncho liners and whatnot. One of them had an RPG sticking out of his ribs. Oh, with sandbags all around it. It was so close. It was like a harpoon. It hadn't detonated. And so all they had was sandbags around that in case it blew up. And they were all dead, and I would not look at faces. We were driving by there and just laying on the street, and they had been brought back through the night. And that was the hospital tent side, and then we were in the hangar on this side, and they were just on the street. And I remember thinking, you know, I don't know what I thought, really. I remember just looking at boots, and I could tell by the boots who they were or who they belonged to, you know. What unit, and it wasn't a good feeling. And then got back to my cot, just started reloading ammo, grabbed some water, grabbed my night vision, trying to grab another radio battery, and I was waiting to find out what was going on. The helicopter started to come back in from the Pakistani stadium where they had driven them to and then flew them back. And they came back, and they would not let us go back out. They wouldn't let us go back out. I think they kind of knew what might happen if we went back out. It's probably a smart move. And we never did go back out. We did some more flights around the city, as we did always 2 to 3 times a day. We'd fly over the city, so they never knew when it was real or not. A new squadron showed up. We took them out and did a rehearsal with them on the beach at a couple of houses just for practice. And it's funny, you could tell who was new and who had been there. Just sitting back watching, you see one squadron over here and one squadron over here. This building over here to, say, the left, you can't see anybody. Everybody's got their head down. They're low crawling. They were the ones that have been there. The new guys, you could see their heads popping out of windows, looking around, you know, like we always did. I was like, well, you guys got a lesson to learn, you know, because you can get shot by a 10-year-old kid with an AK. It doesn't matter. So a lot of luck, I'd say, because training at that time, when there's that many people shooting at you, all the training in the world, you're just going to run out of training, and you start dipping into your luck bucket. I think I scooped everything out that day, and not even a scratch. I'd say not even a scratch until 6 October when the mortar round hit out front of our hangar. Killing Matt Ryerson. I get hit with a chunk of asphalt that where the mortar round hit, flew inside and hit me right below my knee. But other than that, that was nothing. You know, I mean, I went running out to find my friends who was hopping in on one leg. But half of his Achilles tendon was cut with shrapnel. You know, he's hopping in on one leg, and I grabbed him, threw him on a cot. And he's screaming, "Some avenge me, Tom, avenge me!" You know, some funny stuff, but. There's some funny things that happened that aren't so funny at the time, and you look back on them later, they're kind of humorous. But, yeah, how I made it out of there was a lot of luck.
So this happened in 93. This was, what, like 7 or 8 years into your military career? You ended up staying, though, like another 18 or so? 15 to 18 more years, something like that afterwards?
Yeah.
How did your mindset change after that conflict, after that battle where, you know, so many of the people you were friends with, that you were close with, died? What was your mindset like afterwards, and then how did you overcome such a traumatic event like that?
I did not overcome it until, well, I'm still working on it. Maybe two years ago, three years ago, maybe. 4 years ago now, probably a little over 4 years. I didn't even try to overcome it. Until then, it was who I was. It was my culture. I turned off emotions. I turned off love. I turned off. I had zero empathy. I had no empathy for anyone. If you were my mate, my teammate, anybody that worked with me, if you were an American, a good guy, a good person, you had my total and utter and complete support. If you were a bad guy or an enemy or anything against it, I would destroy you, and not even I'd go to bed and, you know, smile all night long. I had no feelings. You're hiding them. It's not true. You know, you're playing a game with yourself. But that was all I bottled up. Everything was just bottled up and packaged away because it didn't have a reason to be in my life. You know, empathy or emotions. I was a horrible person. I look back. I mean, I was a horrible person. And it's just, I got so tired of blaming everyone else and pointing fingers at everyone else and being so angry. And I get that a lot from people. I'm tired of being angry, and I don't want to be angry anymore. And I'm like, you're angry because you choose to be angry. It's a habit. You know, now it's a habit for you. I chose to be angry. I did it for so long. I got so good at it. It was my habit. And now you have to break that habit by being happy. And people, blah, 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 they laugh. You know, and the ones that do it, call me up, thank me for it, because it works. It has to happen, or you're going to, if you do nothing, I can guarantee you one thing, nothing will change. You know, that's the one thing I can guarantee people. you go on this path, you're going to end up feeling the same way you always feel. If you're going to put down every little possible way of getting better as stupid or not manly or not in your realm of thinking, then I can guarantee you, you will stay the same. But everyone that's tried anything different, I'm not saying I have the miracle. I don't have the potion. But when you tell people to put the effort they put into their military training into it, like you put a lot of effort into the military training you did to save your life. You're trying to save your life now. Put the same effort into it, you know? You're still trying to save your life. It's just not from bullets. Well, it might be from bullets, but the one that you did yourself. I've got too many friends that have killed themselves. But I was still that horrible person, you know, four marriages. I mean, how many times before you realize it's, you know, it might be you? You know, you might start thinking there's a common denominator here, and I don't know if it's me or what. So you start to wise up a bit. But a little over 4 years ago, doing a job in Akron, Ohio, and we had a film crew with us, and I was my miserable self. I was drinking myself to death. I mean, literally, it's the culture of the military, and I try so hard to change it. You know, drinking, painkillers, everything that I had because I was given them, because I needed them, you know? And they don't care how many you need. So let's throw a little alcohol on top of that, work through that, have a hard day. And I hit my last day. We parked the car in the parking garage, and everybody walks across a little crossway that goes to the hotel and down the stairs, all supposed to meet in the hotel lobby. And I'm like, hey, I'm going to grab some stuff in the car. I'll catch up with you, you know. Normally I'd be right there at the bar. I'd be the first one in line. And I pulled out my gun. I had it in my lap, and I had two thoughts. Is it in my mouth or to the side of my head? Which is it? Which will do it right, because I don't want to screw it up. And then I remember thinking about which will make a mess, because that's kind of who I was. I didn't think about my family. I mean, I got a 19-year-old son right now. I didn't think about him. And I've said this in a speaking engagement before in a town, and I've hurt some feelings. I preface it. My suicide attempt was selfish. I consider suicide, my personal opinion, consider suicide a selfish act, because you don't think of the many people you touch if you go through with it. You want to solve your problem, you know, with one little thing, but you create hundreds more problems for other people when really you could have solved your problem with a different, you know, avenue versus suicide of any sort. So I was being selfish, and my phone vibrated and buzzed, and it kind of scared me and caught me off guard. And it was one of the camera crew. Hey, you're late. You're supposed to be here. What's up? We're all down here waiting on you. Military kicks back in. I'm like, oh shit, I'm late. Put my gun away. You know, this never happened. Ran downstairs, and I think I've got some pictures that I found of that moment. You can see it in my face. It's sad. You can see it in my face, and then you can see the changes in my face later, because a lot of people made fun of me over it, which is the hurt, because you can see me being happier. And people make fun of that nowadays, like being happy is funny, you know, like it's bad to be happy. You're a military guy. So that person that texted me, I ended up talking to him 6 months later about it, what they did for me. And then I ended up marrying them, married her, for it.
Wow.
Yeah. Not because of that,
but, yeah.
You know, that I'd say that started it. She listens. She lets me talk. She got a lot of the poison out that I hadn't talked about Somalia in 20 years. I mean, I'd been to Iraq. I've been around the world, and done some shit that some of it cool, some of it not cool at all. And you know, to be able to get that out of you, to someone who doesn't judge you, someone who doesn't give you that weird, like, ooh, what look, you know, like, man, maybe I need to go, you know, it's very helpful. And she's been the reason that a lot of my friends are still alive. When they call me and people thank me, I can't wait to hand the phone to her, you know. She's kind of the den mother. When she did video for us for special operations for 4+ some years, SEALs and Green Berets and stuff, she would run around in the muck holes in the shitholes with all these guys. One woman and 300 dudes running around, you know, for weeks on end with no showers and nowhere to go in the bathroom, but guess what? Wherever, you know? Mm. And, you got to go outside at night? Sure, yeah, but the recce's out there with their night vision, so have fun with that one. Oh, you don't want to do that? We'll go inside. Go ahead and go poop in the corner or pee in the corner. That's what we do here, man, you know? And she jumped right in, and it went from her feeling like guys are deploying and we're trying to train them up to these family men are here and talking about their wives and their kids now. And then now they're talking about their problems. And so she kind of became the den mom. And that's when she gave up her career and started to figure out how to help these people stay alive and enjoy their lives more so than just living.
Yeah, it's incredible, man. It sounds like she is like the perfect supportive partner that you'd want and having to deal with something like this. I mean, there's that, like you said, there's so many guys who you've known through the years that have unfortunately killed themselves or haven't been able to handle some of the problems that you've been able to handle, and having someone like that in your corner backing you, giving you their support is unbelievably helpful. And you know, for you it seems like it was life-changing. What are some of the things that you've learned from your problems or your challenges that have stemmed, your PTSD that has stemmed from, you know, 1993 when this all went down? What are some of the things that you carry with you right now in 2018 and going forward too that you didn't have back then, aside from, you know, an incredible supporting wife like you have now?
Yeah, if I'd have met anyone else in the world that day, I'd be dead. Nobody else could have handled me. Nobody else on this planet could have handled me. She was handed me by somebody. Whoever you believe in, whatever you believe in, that person.
Yeah.
What have I learned is that failure, it means get up and do it again. You know, failure is a tool to learn. It's not a reason to quit. Everybody that thinks that there's nothing in life that's insurmountable. There's nothing. Nothing. We put our own time limits on things, you know. Well, there's no way I can do that in that amount of time. Okay, well, you put a time limit on it. But everything can be done, no matter what it is. I don't care if it's you know, you have some issue with your body or your brain or however you're handling things, or something's overgrown or the house needs this or that. Everything can be done. Nothing is insurmountable. I found that. And failure, I have never found a person that has not failed. So why is failure such a bad word? Failure is kind of how I've learned everything in my life. When we go do a mission, or we do a training mission or a real mission or anything, we come back and we talk about it. And what we don't talk about is what we did good, because we're supposed to do that. We would come back and we'd talk about what we did wrong. We talked about the failures, and we didn't get on each other about them. We just addressed them, improved upon them, and moved on. That can be a problem with family living, when all you do is focus on the negative. But it's good for a career, because you don't become afraid to try. I always say the greatest failure is a failure to try, because you're going to fail. But the greatest one is if you never tried at all. I mean, you have zero chance then. I can guarantee you that. I've learned to not be afraid to get up and address anything. Everybody puts on their pants the same, pretty much. And I've learned that I don't give a shit what people think about me. And I tell that to everyone else. If you don't give a shit what people think about you, but only you care about what you think about you, then you better hold yourself in high regard or change it. If you look in the mirror and you're happy, then who gives a shit what anyone else thinks about? You know, you got bullies nowadays. They seem to be climbing and growing. Those kids are the problems. They have problems. And they're projecting them onto kids without problems. Those kids without problems don't know how to deal with that. Their minds aren't developed yet emotionally. They don't know how to handle these things. So they kill themselves. They go crazy and shoot up schools, you know, as a defense mechanism. That's all PTS. When your brain feels like it can't defend itself, or your brain says your body can't defend itself, everything's a threat. What do? We take care of the threat, you know, and it doesn't have to be a rational thought. But if we could teach kids not to give a shit about what other people think about them, I mean, man, what opportunity they would have from an early age to go around feeling emboldened and to feel good about everything that they do. That's the opportunity I wish that children had. But it took me so long to learn it. I'm talking to kids in colleges, they're cadets or just regular college kids as well. And I'm like, the only thing you guys, you know what you guys have on me? I've done all these things if you think are wonderful. The only thing you have on me are 30 plus years. You have 30 plus years to get where I'm at. So why are you in a hurry? Why be in a hurry? You got an extra 30 years before you turn 51 like I am. You know, you just have fun, enjoy life, slow it down, you'll get there. And don't worry about other people think about you. Go out and try something and fail and try again until you get it right, you know, or figure out that it's not what you want to do. But go do it. And above all, and I learned this from my wife, is to live happily. I blame myself for everything in my life because it's the only thing I can control. I can't control external circumstances. I can't control other people. The only thing I can control is myself. And so I blame myself for everything in my life. Of course, I'm going to take credit for all the good stuff, right? But I also blame myself for the bad stuff because I caused it, or I failed to do something to affect it. And when I started doing that, I started being happy. I started to be a happy person. And when I'm a happy person, people around me are happy. It's contagious, and then we all get happy. And the one thing I've connected with other veterans, even from my own organization, even from Delta, from all these years, who people I just barely knew down the hall, I'm more closely associated with the people I didn't know back in the day when I was in the unit than I am with some of the people I was in the most heated combat with. Some of those people can't let go, and I can't make them, but you become like those you surround yourself with. And I had the opportunity to go back recently to good old Fayetteville, North Carolina, and meet some friends out at a bar, and guess what? I saw myself in a mirror 5 years earlier. And I'm thinking, this town, or these people in this town, have not changed a bit. They're not progressing in life. And I have. And I realize that I have. And I'm not being cocky, but I'm being realistic in the fact that I changed my surroundings. I changed who I hung around. I became like those I hung around with better attitudes, better opportunity. And I myself became a better person. I noticed the racist, misogynistic comments, the rude, mean, the argumentative, electoral bullshit going on. That, oh, my God. You know, it's a nightmare. It's like someone turn off Twitter for a little bit here. But I decided then that, man, I had made such a change in my life that I didn't even notice it until then. And then I noticed that the people I did hang around, who I barely knew back in the day, are doing the same things. I got Tom Spooner, Scott Spooner, two brothers. One I put through, I was his instructor when he went to OTC. You know, and his brother Scott Spooner. I hired him as a heavy breacher support guy in the unit to work for me. Two great guys. Tom Spooner started Warrior's Heart, Mission 22, you know. Scott Spooner is out writing books and helping people as well. And things like Teddy Lanier, who guys nearly killed themselves with every drug on the planet that worked with me, that reached up, asked for a hand. And, you know, me and my wife gave him a hand, and within 2 days, he was at Warrior's Heart. A month later, I mean, now we're at a year later. I think we're at a year later now. He's the only one out of the group that has stayed completely clean of everything. He is our pit bull to go to. He's the first guy I would call for anything I ever needed on this planet. He always was before, which is odd. He was on every drug known to man at the time, and I didn't know it. But I would still call him and didn't know it. But now I know that he understands what it's like, not to be on the bottom, but underneath, buried under the bottom. The things he's done and admitted to doing it, and how many people have realized that, yeah, you're right, it is what we all do, and it's a culture thing. Those are the guys that I closely associate myself with, because they've dedicated their lives to helping others, and they too get laughed at. They too have decided not to give a shit what other people think about them. And we're all the same people that somebody calls when they need help now, you know? And that's who I want to be. I want to be the guy somebody calls no matter what time it is. It's a scary thing, but I want to be that guy because, you know, I know how it feels.
Tom, for those listening who, I mean, because what you've been able to overcome, especially in the last 4 years, has just been incredible. Like, it's such a traumatic, tough, incredibly suffering and painful conflict that was in 1993. But then also, perhaps even more insidious or potentially harmful, especially to your psyche, the 20 years after that really just kind of spiraled downhill for you to the point where you wanted to commit suicide. For those listening who may not have endured that type of thing, or for those listening who may actually have endured something similarly destructive and, you know, may have thought of something like committing suicide before, what is your biggest takeaway? What are some of the things that you do on a day-to-day basis that has allowed you to actually grow from this, to become a better man from this, to become a better human being from your experiences? Because I like to think too often that some of the things that I've endured in my past has helped me become the man I am today and helped me, you know, help other guys out and sharing my story, my journey. What are some of the things that you do on a day-to-day basis that has allowed you to reflect on your past and actually grow from that to being, you know, this guy that you are now?
Gratitude and appreciation. If you stop and think about what you really have in your life versus the fact that, you know, oh, my cup of water is too far out of reach, it sucks, or, oh, the TV remote doesn't work, or, oh, you know, this poor thing. We've spoiled ourselves with technology, and it's great that we have it, but we've lost gratitude and appreciation. I wake up, and this is part of my habit change. I would wake up, I just had my 8th back surgery 10 days ago. And 2 days ago, I slipped and fell in the shower. Thought I cracked my ribs and almost broke my wrist, I think. I don't know. I used to wake up or after a fall like that and just be pissed. I'd be pissed off at everybody, you know, right? I fell, but I'm pissed off at the soap. I'm mad at the shower. Who designed this crap? Who, you know, who made this bed? I slipped and fell in the shower the other day, and when I realized my ribs weren't sticking out of my chest and I was alive, I was like, all right, well, I could have cracked my head, you know, I could have went through the window, I could have went through the glass wall and slit my throat, or my poor wife could have walked in and found me knocked out or something. So I'm grateful for the situation I'm in. I can get back up, you know, and wake up in the morning. I used to wake up in the morning in pain and be in a bad mood, and then I'd transmit that to everybody around me all day long, you know. Why is this not picked up? Why is the sink empty? Why is this and that? You know what? Now I wake up, and the second I do that, I change my habit by catching myself, stopping, thinking of something funny, or I do something fun or funny, or I mess with my wife or something, and I change my pattern and my habit, because then I build a different bridge in my brain, you know? I build a different neuron that connects. Instead of negative bridge, it's a positive bridge. And so gratitude and appreciation of the things in life that are positive versus whining about everything in life. If it's horrible and you can't affect it, okay, move on. Let's talk about things we can affect and be happy. You'll change your pattern. You'll change your thought process. You'll change how you talk to people. And you'll literally be a happier person. And if your thoughts are happier, your words are happier. And if your words are happier, you know, everything else around you becomes that way. I just, when I learned to appreciate just the fact that I have air, that I'm on this side of the grass, you know, that's one thing every day. I'm thankful I'm north of the grass instead of south, you know. Okay, now I'm thankful I can get out of bed. I'm thankful my back surgery went well, you know. I'm thankful pain medications are taking away some of that. I'm thankful that my wife Oh, by the way, my stepson broke his hip 3 days ago playing football, so my wife's taking care of me, him who can't move, stepdaughter who's had a cold, and my poor wife's running around, you know, with her own problems and just sucking it up like a champ. So who am I to whine? So I would challenge everyone to change their focus and their pattern. You've got to think about the good things in life, and then you've got to stop blaming everyone else for the bad stuff, because you can't affect it unless you can control it, you know? So take control of your life by taking control of whose fault it is. You can see people kind of racking their brain like, wow, yeah, you're right. I can't really change what everyone else does, but I can change what I do. I can change how I take your opinion of me. Like, I don't give a shit of your opinion of me, you know? Because I know what I've done. I don't need to prove it. I don't need to show off. I don't like that, hey, cool guy stuff. I did all this cool guy crap. I joined the Army, like I said, in an hour. I didn't pick my path. I stumbled onto things that were amazing. I'm grateful I got to see and do and practice and train and meet who I've met. But I'm not going to brag about it, because it's not like I planned it, you know. Even if I did plan it, I wouldn't brag about it, you know. Rock stars, they want to be rock stars their whole lives. Some of them are still in the garage playing the guitar, you know. I'm still pick on my guitar every night and play the same song I finally learned how to play. I don't try to play anything new, right? But you got to put effort into it to get something out of it, and a lot of people aren't willing to do the effort. They want to blame someone else for why they don't have something.
Yeah, I love some of the things you mentioned, of course, the gratitude, appreciation, the responsibility of taking ownership for the things that have happened to you, and then accepting that you are responsible for those things, both good and bad. But you can't focus, you can't dwell on the negative things that happen in life. There's Elliot Hulse, he was on the show many years back, and he was talking, and one of the things that stuck out was that he said that successful people don't always make the right decisions, but they make their decisions right. And so whatever happens to you in life, whether that's something you do and it's a terrible decision, or life just throws some kind of shitstorm your way, you got to make that right. You got to stick with it. You got to stick through it. Take action like you've done and continue to fight through that fight, because at the end of the day, you can make anything right. You can make that decision, or you can make a circumstance right, as long as you stick with it and keep trudging through. And I think you're the epitome of what it's like, of what a successful person has done when he stuck through and actually followed through on taking action every day. If you look back to your life, even 5 years ago, it was completely different than it is today. And the fact that you were able to stick with it, you've been able to help so many other guys who've, you know, had to endure the same type of thing you have. So I think it was a blessing in disguise, as oftentimes a lot of these things are. They're blessings in disguise. And at the end of the day, man, I got so much respect for your story. And, you know, I'm really happy that you were able to come on and share it with us. As a final send-off takeaway message, what would you like to leave our Elite Man audience? And then what's a place that our listeners can check out more about the work that you're up to in the website?
The one thing I would want to tell the audience is, if we think about it, people think suicide or veterans or whoever, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter who you are. And it doesn't matter how important you think your life is, or how unimportant you think your life is. Kate Spade hung herself, 2 days ago? Who just killed themselves? Oh my gosh, forgot their name.
Anthony Bourdain, actually.
Yeah. And people are freaking out. It doesn't matter how wonderful you think other people's lives are. They're not. We all have a secret. We all have secrets that drive us insane. And if we don't talk about it and share it, and we keep that secret, it's going to affect us for the rest of our lives. Rock stars kill themselves. Movie stars kill themselves. And everybody thinks, why? They're so rich. They have everything they've ever wanted. They've worked hard. They've got big, huge houses all over the world. Why would they kill themselves? Well, they feel different. They feel not part of the tribe. They don't feel like they belong. Everybody belongs. I feel that everybody belongs. I used to pick who's here, who's there. I used to, you know, judge people. We all judge people. I used to judge people, and I realized that people are people with problems. People need help. And so I reached out, and somebody helped me. So now I want to reach down, and I want to help anybody. So no problem is too small. I didn't plan on killing myself. I didn't take a week to think about it. It took me a matter of seconds to make that decision. So just because you're not thinking about it and they ask you that question, have you ever had thoughts of hurting yourself, you know, and those tests that you take sometimes, everybody says no, you know, even terrorists would, are you a terrorist of the United States? Yes, I guess so. You call me. I mean, nobody's going to answer yes to those questions. So we all have these secrets that we think are special to us. And the more people I get together that talk, the more we find out all of our secrets are the same, and therefore they're not secrets, you know? So we're all the same to get to talk. So to be able to reach people, you can go to allsecurefoundation.org. You know, I've got an email address. It's tom@allsecurefoundation.org, you know? And my wife has one, jen@allsecurefoundation.org. You can go to our Facebook page of All Secure Foundation. So many different ways to reach us, and we will get whoever they need, the help they need, as fast as possible. And the number one point is, don't sit there and say you don't have a problem. If you're already thinking about it or wondering, you do. And if you call me or text me, email me, Facebook me, whatever, Twitter, we're on Twitter as well, All Secure Foundation. And I'm sorry, some of these things I'm new to. That's my wife's department. But there's nothing that's not worth talking about. When people call, and I'll spend an hour or two, maybe I'm not doing it right, I got a poor business model, I'll spend all night with somebody if I have to. I'm not doing it for turnout. We're doing it to help people. And I get off the phone and they don't need to go anywhere. They just needed to talk. That's great. I've helped some SAS guys, some guys there around the world. We all have the issues. And sometimes it's just talking about it and someone telling you, you're not that bad. You're normal. You think, I thought the same thing. My wife's been on phone calls with people. Well, I bet your husband's never done this though. She's like, nope. Check that one. Well, I bet he's never done that. Nope. Double check that one. Oh, well, so I guess my husband's not as screwed up as I thought. Well, no, he might be screwed up, but he's as normal as the other screwed up guys are. And help is here. You can get help. I hate people feeling helpless. I hate people feeling like, well, your problem's different than mine. I'll take everyone's excuses away from as fast as I can. I grew up poor. I was picked on. My wife was picked on. You know, I got picked on for playing violin. I sucked at sports. I tried all of them. You know, I was never anybody. I was never that special. Nobody will remember me from high school. People probably remember me from the unit. But for how long? We're all just numbers passing through life, you know, and one day my energy is going to pass on and go somewhere else. Hopefully it takes on a better form and a better life and I have a great time too, but make your time now matter. Talk about your problems. The worst that could happen is nothing. That's the worst thing that'll happen is nothing, and you'll feel the same.
And real quick, is the site allsecurefoundation.org and the help that you offer, is that just exclusively to vets or is that for anybody?
It's veterans. We've helped anybody who's hit us up. We've kept it to special operations veterans, but we've never denied a phone call. We've never denied anyone help, but we're not set up to take on, you know, we've actually spoke at first responder venues as well. A lot of firefighters and law enforcement officers have the same issues of what they see every day. Nurses, everybody, anybody can have PTS. I'll talk to anybody. Because how you got it doesn't matter. A back injury, did you pull it picking up a quarter? Did you slip on the ice or did you get blown up? Doesn't matter. It still hurts, right? Treatment's the same. You got to lay off for a bit, let it heal. Same way with PTS. Doesn't matter how you got it. It needs to be talked about. You need time and you need methods to heal it. We just aren't outfitted yet. But I would probably pass people along very quickly to some other phone number that I could help with. But mostly we've stuck with special operations veterans and then other veterans and then anyone else who calls. But like I said, we've never turned down a phone call. Like, oh, sorry, wrong number kind of thing. That's just be like someone calling the suicide hotline. And went, yep, nope, not wrong number. You know, yeah. It's just be difficult to do for me.
Yeah. All right, cool. No, just thanks for clearing that up. So, yeah, definitely check that out, guys. Tom, again, thanks so much for coming on, man. Really do appreciate your time, and thanks for sharing your story. I think a lot of guys can relate to that, whether they're military or not. I think they can relate to and connect with the power of overcoming some of the major challenges that you were able to overcome and then becoming a better man from that. Tom, thanks again for coming on, man. I'll talk to you soon, so take care, and thank you again.
Thank you, Justin. Appreciate the time.
All right, guys, I hope you enjoyed that episode. But before you go, there's one last thing I need you to do. I need you to subscribe to this podcast right now if you haven't already. By subscribing to the podcast, you get every single episode the minute they're released. Get all of our Elite Man podcast interviews with all of our incredible world-class guests from the lifestyle, health, fitness, business, and social worlds absolutely free. Subscribe now, guys, if you haven't already, and enjoy all future episodes. And yes, if you do love the podcast, leave us an awesome review. We really do appreciate it.